Let me throw a different question at you regarding this particular film. You started this movie, you started shooting it in 2004, so you must have been putting it together before then.
That's right. I was writing it in 1999 is when I started writing it.
Wow.
Okay, so now just out of curiosity here, say you're one of your investors and I've given you my money in 2004 and now it's 2011. Right. I'm looking at my wrist and tapping my watch and I'm standing in front of you. How do you go ahead and, I don't know, I guess essentially buy more time? You know, how do you manage that aspect of it?
Number one, I have really wonderful investors. I mean, they're people who believe in the project.
This is Patrick Reed Johnson being interviewed in 2011 by, well, by me. Patrick is one of those guys who is destined to be in the industry. He's done pretty much everything you can do in the industry. He's made models, visual effects, he was a second unit director, done some writing, and yes, he's directed some features as well.
Okay, so the big question is, when is this movie coming out?
Well, isn't that the question? Probably just a few months after it's finished.
And the movie I keep charmingly asking Patrick about is a personal one. It's Patrick's own story about growing up in small-town Illinois in the 1970s and somehow ending up in Hollywood. It's a coming-of-age story of a nerdy, sci-fi-loving kid. And at the time of this 2011 interview, this film of his had not been finished, even though filming had initially wrapped in 2004. This leads to a fairly obvious question.
How long before the movie is finished? And what is holding up the finishing of the film?
It's a long story, as you can imagine.
And he's right. It is a long story. But what Patrick doesn't know in 2011 is just how long of a story it's going to be. In fact, it's going to be so long that we might not have an ending to it just yet. My name is Dan Delgado, and in this episode, we're taking a look at the very long road taken to get one film finished in the story we're calling A Not-So-New Hope. Welcome to the industry. Patrick Reed Johnson does not want me to spoil his movie 52577. After all, he's been working on it now for years, and the last thing he wants is some podcaster giving everything away. The tricky part about this is that the movie's story is also Patrick's story, which is the story I'm trying to tell. So in my conversation with him, he would frequently say things like,
And I won't tell you what happened. I will only tell you that it changed my DNA.
And
again, I don't want to give too much away about what happened.
The thing is, Patrick's own story is really great, and it's hard for him not to tell it. So eventually he does.
And I'm giving away a little more than I should, but what the hell.
Working in the industry is something that Patrick Reed Johnson wanted to do from a ridiculously early age.
I knew I wanted to make movies at the tender age of 6 years old. The day I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, its first week of release, with my parents, and by the end of it, I just said, I'm doing that. However they did that, that's what I want to do with the rest of my life. They said, well, you graduate kindergarten, we'll see how it goes. But that was it. Everything I did from the day after I got out of that theater was devoted to trying to do that.
It didn't matter that he lived in small town Illinois, which in the 1970s must have seemed like it was a million miles away from Hollywood. He was going to make movies no matter what.
I was the only geek in town. And my way of surviving that was to just create my own little sort of movie studio on my property. When my dad left, I took over the garage because we didn't have to keep his, beautiful Corvette Stingray perfectly dust-free and clean at all times. And once he was gone, the basement where he had his art studio became my studio. And the swimming pool, well, that became my insert tank. And with my mom busy raising three other kids younger than me, she was pretty much, look, if you're occupied and staying out of trouble, I don't care what you do. Take over as much as you want. And movies create families.
So Patrick, the movie-loving kid who needed his own tribe, found his by making movies in his backyard. Though using your tribe to be in the backyard version of Jaws had its own challenges.
One of the things was my friends would mostly get bored after a day or two of working on any project because they didn't think it was serious in the first place. They were just there because something something crazy was going to happen. I was going to ask him to wear some weird thing or some mask or have him fall out of a tree into a mattress or, you know, have blood bags in the pool. Or they get to be killed in wonderful ways every week, right? But after that, the actual business of making an actual film with coverage and remembering lines and stuff, they couldn't have cared less. So that was probably one of the reasons I had to keep starting new projects, was to get them to go, oh, yeah, yeah, that sounds cool, let's do that. Yeah. But it was a way of having a group of people care about something I cared about every time we started a new project. You know, it was a way of developing a set of friends that you could hang out with.
And it was only a matter of time before Patrick fulfilled his destiny and left Wadsworth, Illinois for the bright lights of Hollywood.
I knew I had to leave. I just was trying to figure out any way possible to make that not so. And I think in my way, I believed that I would either eventually make something good enough that people would say, wow, he's really good at this, let's give him money and let it, and he could keep making it right there in Wadsworth, Illinois, population 750, no problem. Really believing that, except, of course, as I got older and then once I was exposed to Hollywood for the first time, which is part of the movie, and seeing what was really both possible, expected, and at stake, I knew immediately that there was no way that that was going to happen, and that I had to either go there, give up everything that I built back in Wadsworth, Illinois, and grow up, or find some insane way of changing Wadsworth enough that I wouldn't mind staying there the rest of my life. And that's where the movie comes in.
Fast forward to the 1990s. By this point, Patrick had been in the industry for years, making models, doing effects, writing, and even directing. He made his directorial debut with Space Invaders in 1990, a low-budget comedy about some short, goofy aliens who come to Earth on Halloween, and everyone just thinks they're little kids in costumes.
From Touchstone Pictures, they were just out cruising the galaxy. Till they ran out of gas.
Aw, man.
And ran into the locals.
Hey, can we borrow a gallon of this?
Now they're looking for help.
Could we borrow a gallon of...
You what a dweeb.
Looking for action.
Hey, Gus. Hey, babe, loosen up.
And getting into a lot of trouble.
Hey, you're drinking bleach.
Faster, dude. Spaced Invaders.
You dudes like heavy metal?
Guess not.
Rated PG. Starts Friday, April 27th at a theater near you.
Disney put it in 1,500 theaters, and it made probably $15 million at the box office, which doesn't seem like a lot, except it only cost two. So at the time, and then went on to be huge in video for Disney. And Disney, you know, they even put it in their stockholders report saying, people should make more movies for this kind of money that are this good so that we can make this kind of money on movies this small.
His follow-up was the John Hughes production, Baby's Day Out, a high-concept comedy about a baby wandering around the big city while being chased by three bumbling crooks.
Meet Baby Bake. He's a genuine joy.
You got a nasty little surprise for me?
Adorable summer fun.
Don't you get into any mischief, well, Dad's gone.
Hilarious.
If you were a baby, where would you go?
Kids will love it.
There he is!
From John Hughes.
You had quite an adventure today.
Baby's Day Out. Directed by Patrick Reed Johnson. Rated PG. Starts Friday at theaters everywhere.
It was a big-budget summer release that didn't really catch on. He also wrote Dragonheart, a movie that he was scheduled to direct but ended up getting pushed out of the project. And this brings us to the late 1990s, where he's set up at Universal and developing different projects. And he's also become friends with Gary Kurtz, a producer who is likely best known for producing Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and American Graffiti. Patrick and Gary begin tossing around ideas for movies. And then one day, Patrick decides to share something personal with Gary.
He's involved in a bunch of these projects with me, and we're having the time of our lives, and I'm getting to work with, you know, one of my heroes. And one day, I say, just offhand, I say, you know, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I saw Star Wars long before it came out. And he goes, really? Wait, like test screening or something? And I said, no. Long before you probably even did test screenings, or at least any that I ever knew of or anything else. And he goes, well, when did you see it? And I gave him the date. And he said, wait a minute. And he started thinking and did the mental math. And he goes, if you saw Star Wars on that day, you are the first human being that didn't either work on it or have something to do with marketing it or have some, you know, you the first non-professional that would be involved with seeing it to have ever seen it. And he goes, you're fan one. And I said, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Fan one. Patrick Reed Johnson is the first person to have seen Star Wars. Pretty cool. And the story of how he came to see it is one of those things he doesn't want me to tell you. So I won't. But that story is the one movie idea that Gary really dug.
Without knowing I was pitching a movie, I pitched him the movie that is 525-77. And he goes, well, why aren't we developing that? That's the movie. That's what you have to write. Go write that. So I did. You know, and we finally, it took a long time. I mean, I started writing it in 1999.
It makes sense. Seeing Star Wars changed Patrick's life. And the title of his movie, 525-77, in case you don't know, is the day Star Wars was released. Patrick gets down to business writing in 1999 and has the movie in production by 2004. And he's got a nice cast, too. John Francis Daly, who you might know from Freaks and Geeks, is playing the movie version of Patrick, and the supporting cast has familiar faces like Austin Pendleton, Colleen Camp, and Neil Flynn. One thing to keep in mind is that this is very much an independent production, even though when it was first conceived, Patrick is set up at Universal. And while he could have had this movie done with a studio and a good budget, that would have meant story compromises. And being that this is Patrick's own story, that just wasn't going to happen.
We actually brought it to some major studios, a couple of which were happy to make it, but a certain incredibly high-powered executive at Disney at the time said, I'll make this movie tomorrow. I said, but he goes, I know you, Patrick, and I need to tell you something. You're not going to want to make the version of this that I'm going to greenlight, because if I greenlight this, it's going to have to be like Road Trip for movie makers. It's going to have to be lots of sex, drugs. I don't have any problem showing any of that in my films at all. I would be happy to. The problem was he was saying, I don't need you showing it. You're going to have to make basically a comedy out of what is really an intense drama with lots of fun.
The production wraps in 2004, but the movie's not finished. There's more footage needed, so a year later they do some more shooting. And after looking at everything, they realize they're still not done. In 2006, there's more shooting. Post-production is where things really grind to a slow crawl. Money is tight, and those special effects and music rights aren't going to pay for themselves. A couple of more years go by, and it's still not finished. Then, there's the period in which the William Morris Agency had creative ownership of the movie. They decided changes needed to be made. That title, 525-77, too clunky, change it! So they shortened it to 77. See, it's much cleaner that way. They also wanted to cut some scenes out as well. None of this went over well with Patrick. But eventually, he's back in control of his movie and the title gets restored. And even though the movie gets screened at festivals periodically and gets an overwhelmingly positive reaction each time, it's still not finished. And remember in 2013, when people were going Kickstarter crazy? When Veronica Mars fans gave the show's creator $5.7 million to make a movie that would end up grossing $3.4 million? When filmmakers like Spike Lee and Paul Schrader were kickstarting movies and it seemed like anything was possible? Patrick was still in need of funding to get the movie done. So he gets an idea.
So it started out as a half, like a test screening tour meets publicity stunt meets attempt to create a kind of sales pitch long form video for like a Kickstarter campaign to get the damn movie finished.
That's right. A tour and a Kickstarter. By this time in 2013, movie geeks are well aware of 525-77. It's almost like this mythical movie that they'd heard about for almost 9 years now. The idea was to tour the country, show the unfinished version in a bunch of towns, create a word of mouth, the buzz in the industry, and maybe get the funding the movie needs. So they get the Pinto used in the movie and an old RV.
And we filled it with editing machines and Macintoshes and put GoPro cameras all over it, and we had two chase vehicles with GoPro cameras on them, and we had the Pinto with two or three GoPro cameras on it, and off we went. We took off from Waukegan, Illinois, in front of the Genesee Theater. That was where it all began, and we crossed the country.
The tour gets going, full of hope and passion and love.
Heading to places like a comic book store in Omaha, Nebraska, right? And then a comic book store in Colorado somewhere. I can't remember what town it was. And then on to Devil's Tower and to the KOA campground that served originally as the base of operations in Close Encounters, where we showed the movie on a giant hand-strung screen that we built out on the back deck of this campground, convenience store deck that was situated. So the Devil's Tower was right there, right behind the screen.
And everything is going great for a while. And then things are not so great.
They would keep raising money on the goodwill of people that thought, hey, I like this movie, and I like what you guys are up to. And so we kept dropping these videos, like, hey, if you can just help us, we can go to the next town, we can go to the next town. And we started losing people to attrition. I mean, people got tired, they got cranky, they had to go on with their lives. And it slowly started getting a tinier and tinier group.
And what started out as a feel-good project with good intentions has devolved into something else.
This was supposed to be a 30-day trip, but because we would run out of gas, we'd run out of money, we'd run out of funding, sometimes we'd be stuck for days. At one point, we were at a campground in, I think, Kansas. Middle of nothing, Kansas. Beautiful campground. But we couldn't move. We literally couldn't get out of there because we'd run out of money.
Patrick's 30-day trip ended up taking 143 days. In that time, he would travel to 14 states, log 7,000 miles, and one foreign country, Canada. While it certainly didn't go the way it was intended, there were some highlights. The final stop in Montreal, for example, featured two sold-out screenings at Fantasia Fest, where fans ate the movie up. When it was all said and done, though, the tour didn't raise the funds or generate the buzz it was meant to. Despite all the stops and successful receptions at screenings held across the United States, 52577 remained unfinished. And now, several years after the tour is over, it's still unfinished. According to Patrick, the cast remained supportive. John Francis Daly, the lead of the movie, has gone on to be a successful screenwriter and director. He co-wrote Spider-Man Homecoming and directed Game Night, and he still gets a call from Patrick from time to time.
The funny thing was is that they all were involved with each new iteration because we had to sometimes shoot new material with them. John Francis Daly, bless his heart, has not only been there back in the day, but even as recently as, just a week or two before we put together the mix for the 2017 release, we lost a certain song, and so we needed to redo some lines to cover for it in this car sequence, and he pulled out his microphone at home and recorded the lines and sent them to me as files, and no problem. I mean, in the middle of directing his next project, whatever it was, and he's always been there, all of them.
So the question remains, what is the holdup here? What's left, if anything, to do? Well, there are a few things, actually.
There is color timing, that sort of thing.
Okay, that's one thing.
There needs to be a final sound mix. There's a really good temp mix, but it needs to be finaled.
All right, that's two.
The main thing right now is we're also paying for all the music. So we've got a little tiny bit of chunk of money we just got to bring to the party in the next month or so.
That's three, and that's always the worst because music rights always cost.
But other than that, the movie's finished.
Depending on how you look at it, it does seem that Patrick is close to the finish line. And the movie does still show up at festivals in whatever the most recent form of it is. There was even a one-day nationwide release on 5/25/2017, the 40th anniversary of Star Wars. Though Patrick calls that a stunt release. In the years since he started, a lot has changed for Patrick. When he's not working on 5/25/77 or a slew of other projects he has going, he's now a professor at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. He had his students in mind when I asked him what is probably an obvious question that he's heard a few times, I'm going to guess. In your journey with this movie, right, this journey that's been going on for years that seems to be to the end, was there a point where you thought, this is not going to get finished? I should just move on to something else. I need to put this away and focus on something else.
Nope. I mean... Another thing I tell my students, and it's just a truth that they can choose to believe or not, the most absolute certain way to not make it in Hollywood is to give up. And a lot of these young people will say, so how long do I have to wait, like, when I graduate before I get a job as director? And he said, longer than you're going to be able to if you're asking that question. Because, first of all, it's unanswerable, other than you have to wait until you get a job as a director. That's what you have to wait for. And they don't want to hear that. They're going to say, oh, come on. I mean, really, like a year? Is it 2 years? And the answer is, it is that's not answerable. And if you need that answer, it's likely you'll give up possibly the day before you would have gotten your shot. There's no quitting. The people I know who've made it at all in Hollywood, when I use the term Hollywood now, I mean the world of filmmaking. The only ones I know who ever made it were ones who simply said, I'm just going to do it. I mean, I'm doing this.
It's hard not to root for Patrick. He still talks about 525-77 with a passion, and the guy is just indefatigable. And believe it or not, he's closer than ever to being finished. Really. He's hoping to have it out in theaters and streaming by December of 2019, around the same time as the next Star Wars movie, Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, is released. This means at some point, I'll have to edit this podcast with an update. But I'm okay with that. As long as it's good news. Thank you for listening to The Industry. This episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Dan Delgado. Special thanks to my guest, Patrick Reed Johnson. Music in this episode is by Jeremy Blake and the 126ers. This is the final episode of Season 2 of The Industry, so I'd like to give a big thank you to Kat Manderfield, who did the episode art for this episode and every episode this season. You can check Kat out at her website, katmanderfield.com. Also thanks to Jessica Pack, who you heard laughing in the opening part of this program. Jessica has given me a very helpful proof listen to each episode this season. If you have any complaints or you just want to say hi, you certainly can. Email me at dan@theindustrypodcast.com, or you could follow me on Twitter at theindustry13 and on Instagram at industry_podcast. You can still rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and now on podchaser.com. If you aren't familiar with it, Podchaser is a sort of IMDb for podcasts. Check it out. Show notes and links are available at our website, industrypodcast.org/articles. There's also a link to the trailer for 525-77. Definitely check that out. If you missed an episode, you can also find them all hanging out there at the same website, industrypodcast.org. But I'm sure whatever app you're using has them. And speaking of apps, there's honestly lots of great podcast apps out there. But CastBox is one that I absolutely love and that gives a lot of love back to indie podcasts like this one. You should be using them if you're not. No pressure, though. I'll be taking a break for the holidays and should be back with new episodes sometime in 2020. Stay subscribed, though, because I will try to put out a bonus episode or two in the interim. No guarantees, though. Again, thank you for listening. I'll be back again soon with another story of the lesser-known things that went on in the industry. Good night.